I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is Joshua Blakeney, who is a British journalist based in Calgary, Canada. And the reason I'm interviewing him is that he was kind enough to interview me recently, and I thought it turned out really quite well. And as we conversed, I thought, you know, I'd like to get to know this guy better. And so I thought, well, why don't I just interview him? So, Joshua, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Greg. It's a great pleasure to talk with you.
Let's begin with a little bit of sort of basic background. Where are you from? How old are you? What kind of background do you have? Where did you go to school? Things like that.
Yeah, so I was born in Surrey, UK, 4.5 miles from where the Magna Carta was signed. And in 2005, my mother and I emigrated to Canada. When I was sort of 14, 15, 16, I started coming over for vacations to Montana. My mother's an artist, and she was very interested in Native Americans and Native American art. So she began taking me to the Blackfoot Indian Reservation in Montana. And so we used to fly to Calgary and travel down to Montana. So that's how I sort of became acquainted with this part of the world. So in 2005, I moved to Alberta, Canada. And I went traveling around the world in 2005. But by 2006, I had returned to Canada. And I had enrolled in a sociology program at the University of Lethbridge, the Canadian province of Alberta. Sort of has three main universities, which are the University of Lethbridge, the University of Calgary, and the University of Alberta in Edmonton. And, you know, I had sort of become enamored with left-wing ideas. You know, I was reading a lot of Che Guevara when I was traveling and kind of imagining myself on this sort of socialistic motorcycle trip like Che Guevara did. So I was a leftist, and when I enrolled in sociology, you know, obviously that gave me a lot of latitude to explore different ideas. But by 2007, I had walked into a class entitled Globalization Since 1492. And in that class, I would meet and befriend Professor Anthony James Hall, who is a professor of globalization studies at the University of Lethbridge. And we really struck up a good friendship, and eventually he would become my graduate studies supervisor. And he, at that time, was beginning to sort of come off the fence on 9/11. He'd been a professor of Native American studies. His PhD was in history from the University of Toronto. And he also described himself as a red Tory. So he was the first person who I met, really, who sort of legitimized the idea that certain factions on the right can be revolutionary. That you know, I used to sort of think the left had this monopoly on justice and truth, or a pursuit of justice and truth, and that if you were a rightist, you were sort of ipso facto bad. But Professor Hall characterized himself as an indigenous Canadian conservative, and he sort of resented what he viewed as kind of Likudnik and Republican iterations of conservatism contaminating Canadian conservatism. And so Professor Hall had a very interesting take. He's a sort of revisionist when it comes to the American Revolution. He sort of used King George III as the good guy. He draws attention to the fact that the founding fathers of the United States were very frustrated with the way the British Empire were containing the settlers in the 13 colonies and preventing them from spreading westward. And in the Declaration of Independence, you have a reference to King George having brought on the merciless Indian savages whose known rule of warfare is the undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. And so he contrasted this with the output of the first British Indian agent in North America, Sir William Johnson. And he'd been instrumental in enabling the Royal Proclamation of 1763, where basically the British Empire had outlawed westward expansion through vigilantism and the murdering of Native Americans. And so Professor Hall kind of views Canada as having emerged in a more kind of benign way vis-a-vis Native Americans. You know, Canada was founded by French, British, and Aboriginals. And so he has this whole very sort of unique take on the American Revolution. And obviously, Canada was being dragged into these 9/11 wars as a result of the official interpretation of 9/11. But the reason I mention his background in Native American studies was that he was working closely with a man named Splitting the Sky. Splitting the Sky had been involved in the Attica prison rebellion, which, you know, John Lennon had taken up the cause of the so-called Attica brothers. And he'd been scapegoated for having murdered a prison guard, William Quinn, at Attica. And Ramsey Clark, the former Attorney General of the United States, took up Splitting the Sky's cause. But anyway, so Splitting the Sky came to live in Canada, and Professor Hall would invite him to lecture to his students. And obviously, it was a very unique kind of lecture talking about rape in prison and you know, having prison guards coming in and putting sheets around your neck and saying, we'll say you hung yourself in prison, you know. So he'd come and lecture in that regard to the students. And he was in New York on September 10th and September 9th. And he said he witnessed all these FEMA people walking around. And he just had this hunch that this was, you know, there was more to the official explanation, which we were given sort of within hours of what transpired on 9/11, which then that official interpretation is sort of stuck to this day, right? So he was telling Professor Hall, look, this just isn't, you're not a serious academic if you just presuppose this official story of 9/11. You're going to have to introduce the scholarly works of people like David Ray Griffin to your students. Professor Griffin now has written like 11 very methodical books debunking the official story of 9/11. And so Professor Hall, as I walked into his class, you know, he was trying to introduce this literature to the students. And I found his class just really unique. You know, most of the pedagogy you get in post-secondary institutions in North America is, in my view, very redundant. Often you find professors have a lot of pressure on them to pump out lots of publications. So they, you know, a lot of them, they just get a textbook that's written by a Harvard scholar and summarize it in a PowerPoint presentation. And then they give you a multiple choice test that's marked by a computer. You know, not a lot of effort is put into the pedagogy. But in the case of Professor Hall, he really wanted to do globalization studies. And in that vein, he'd often, for example, go to Poland and sit with professors in Poland. And he'd appear in the class through Skype. And he needed someone to assist him. So I sort of morphed into being his teacher's assistant. And so when my sociology degree culminated in 2010, he said, why don't you begin doing graduate studies and why don't you try and address 9/11 and what did and did not happen on 9/11? I mean, the origins of World War One, the origins of World War Two, they're legitimate subjects for academic inquiry. So why not the origins of the global war on terror? So I would then one day woke up and I had an email saying, congratulations, you've been awarded the prestigious Queen Elizabeth II graduate scholarship, because I'd graduated with a fairly high GPA with my undergrad degree. And the national media, the Zionist owned and operated media in Canada, kind of got wind of that and decided to make national news out of the fact that a post-secondary institution in Alberta was, quote unquote, using taxpayer money to fund so-called conspiracy theories. I ended up with a former Mossad agent named Michael Ross contacting my university at one point. And so there was a lot of pressure mounted on my university. I began being demonized in the Canadian media, as did Professor Hall, because we were questioning the official story of 9/11. Up until that point, I had taken an interest in the Israel-Palestine conflict. I'd helped to found a chapter of Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights at my university. But in my mind, I compartmentalized the war on terror and the Israel-Palestine conflict. I still subscribed to this idea that this was the evil American empire and that, you know, what was going on in Palestine could be divorced from the war on terror. But gradually, you came to realize that the people who were zealously trying to defend and inoculate the official story of 9/11 were largely Jewish Zionists. And then one thing I also was exposed to in the 9/11 truth movement was the fact that really these days it's only certain elements on the right who care about truth. And as I had gone through my sociology degree, obviously I had been subjected to Frankfurt School type neo-Marxist doctrines. And I had always found myself disliking that paradigm. I began calling myself at one point a paleo-Marxist because I liked the old economistic version of Marxism, where the goal was to sort of focus on redistributing wealth in a very kind of scientific way that, in my view, was still sort of rooted in the Western tradition. And I didn't like the works of Marcuse and of Adorno and of Kristeva, all these people whose work was foisted upon me at university. So I had this aversion to sort of neo-Marxism. I read the book Fashionable Nonsense, Postmodern Intellectuals' Abuse of Science by Alain Sokal and Jean Brigmont. They had actually submitted an academic paper to a postmodern journal that was deliberately gobbledygook, that was deliberately just nonsense, and they had it accepted to this postmodern journal. And their book was basically explaining why postmodernism is just sort of nonsense. So So yeah, so still to this day, I'm obviously from a different angle. I'm a critic of neo-Marxism. Now I'm sort of more aware of, you know, for example, the work of Professor Kevin MacDonald. But even when I was a Marxist, I didn't like that. I felt it was wishy-washy. I didn't really see how it was constructive or progressive. You know, I was still sort of very much rooted in the idea of progress, the Enlightenment idea of progress. And I felt that neo-Marxism, postmodernism, it was just leading to identity politics, the kind of thing that divided the working class. I didn't see how it was going to fructify in any way. So that was kind of the thought processes that I was going through. But yeah, so I had this mentor who was a red Tory, a revolutionary conservative, you could say. And then I became heavily involved with the 9/11 truth movement, and a big faction of the 9/11 truth movement are sort of US patriot types or US isolationists, libertarians, the kind of people who I was told by sociology professors to hate, you know, sort of white patriotic Americans, but people who happen to oppose war. And I didn't really understand why I should dislike these people. And as I say, I began to sort of respect them a great deal because they believed in truth and in empirical evidence. Whereas the left, you could see that a lot of the left was dropping the ball on this issue of false flag terrorism and 9/11 and later the issue of the Israel lobby and so on, for ideological reasons, that the left was basically completely divorced from any idea of the pursuit of truth or, you know, even just like a scientific method, that the left has sort of abandoned that in favor of this radical ideological agenda, which I now know is heavily influenced by sort of Jewish group evolutionary strategies. So yeah, so I became friends with the 9/11 truth movement, and I slowly began to sort of shed any ideological framework or any ideological shackles I had and just sort of say, okay, let's just go for truth and justice and follow that idea, and wherever that leads me is where I'll end up. And so I've sort of ended up now gravitating toward people like yourself, because like you said in the interview I conducted with you recently, Greg, you know, your paradigm rests upon the Western tradition, and I think there is a lot to be said for the Western tradition, you know. And so mixed into all this, I've been going to Japan. I've been to Japan several times. I first went there when I was 19. Obviously that's an ethnocentric society, it's a patriarchal society, and things are better there. And it's hard to, so on the one hand I had this ideology of Marxism, and I had this sort of little Japanese person on my shoulder saying, but our society is better. Why are you promoting all these, you know, radical feminism and multiculturalism and so on, when clearly the society you've witnessed, which seems to be most stable, where women are stable in their identities, where there's sort of harmony to some extent between the ruling class and the working class, where the ruling class still have this idea of shame, which contrasts, of course, with the shamelessness, the chutzpah of the people who rule over us currently. So yeah, so that I'm influenced heavily by Japan. I was pleased to see on your website you had some writings dedicated to Yukio Mishima. I've just completed reading Henry Stokes's wonderful biography of Mishima. Of course, Yukio Mishima was the literary icon who attempted a sort of symbolic coup in November 1970 with the hope of reinstating basically the pre-1945 dispensation in Japan. So I'm heavily influenced by Japan, and my most recent visit there was in September of this year, and I went to the National Archives in Japan, and I pulled out a bunch of publications. At university I had studied Japanese, I should add that, so I'm reasonably conversant in Japanese. And anyway, so I went to the National Diet Library and pulled out a bunch of publications, and I'm currently typing them up, and I'm hoping to republish them. So yeah, so there's all kinds of variables. Living with Native Americans in Montana, you know, my childhood, I spent a lot of time in Europe, trips to Japan, and then, you know, living in Zionist-occupied North America. So all these things have sort of synthesized to produce my current worldview. Yeah, I hope that helps.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. Let me ask you, just in a nutshell, if that's possible, tell me what you think actually happened on September 11th, 2001.
Yeah, so look, in 1979, the Israelis hosted this Jerusalem conference on international terrorism, and they proposed an international war on something called international Islamic terrorism. And, you know, I have books on my bookshelf, edited by people like Benjamin Netanyahu. Like, I found this book called Terrorism, How the West Can Win, published in 1986 by Benjamin Netanyahu, explaining why it was so necessary for the West, this, you know, this idea of Israel and the Jews being part of this so-called Judeo-Christian West, fighting international Islamic terrorism. The problem, of course, was that you're more likely statistically to die from lightning or in the bathtub than from terrorism in countries like America and Canada and Britain. So there is no significant terrorist threat in our countries. So Israel has a vested interest in destabilizing the Middle East. The US, the American empire, obviously like a rational empire, was trying to foment stability in the Middle East after World War II to do lucrative trade with the Middle East. Like, if you're investing in a company, you know, and you want them to go to the Middle East, you're not going to send your company and your investment there if things are going to be blowing up and if there's going to be ethnic sectarianism. But Israel has a vested interest in that. And a lot of your listeners, I'm sure, will be familiar with the Oded Yanon plan. It's a sort of notorious document, a strategy for Israel in the 1980s, in which the Israeli foreign policy analyst Oded Yanon basically says this, that, you know, if Israel plays her cards right, she can break up the modern Arab states along sectarian lines and rule over them. Actually, the Ottoman Empire did that. They had the millet system, where they reduced the Middle East to ethnic and confessional fiefdoms and managed to sort of rule the Middle East that way. So basically, Israel had this problem where there was a big faction in the U.S. establishment who wanted stability in the Middle East. Of course, George Bush Sr., after the first Gulf War, did not go in and topple Saddam. And if you look at the statements of the George Bush government at the time, they basically said, well, we'll just create mayhem in Iraq. Why would we do that? We just wanted to force Saddam to recede from Kuwait and go back to the status quo ante of stability in the Middle East. So Israel had this quagmire. And I think that pro-Zionist elements within the neoconservatives, like the neoconservative movement, basically, as we know, was a kind of Jewish intellectual movement with people like Douglas Feith and Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Perle, who are, you know, unregistered agents of the Israeli government operating within the U.S. establishment. I gather Feith and Wolfowitz had lost their security clearances in the 1980s for passing classified documents to Israel. That these people said, and they actually said this openly in their PNAC document, we need a new Pearl Harbor. And you know, there was Israeli agents arrested on 9/11. Larry Silverstein, who, according to Haaretz, has a weekly phone call with the Israeli prime minister and who has investments throughout the occupied territories, bought the World Trade Centers, changed his insurance policy so he would get paid out in the event of a terrorist attack for each building that was hit, basically cashing in on that. And it's been a Jewish judge who has been overseeing all these sort of 9/11 related cases in the New York area. That, you know, they rigged the buildings up in some capacity, and there's all kinds of factionalism and debate in our 9/11 truth movement over was nanothermite used or was nanothermite not used, and was it a mini nuke that brought down the towers. You know, there's all kinds of, you know, the 9/11 truth movement does have its crank wing of people who want to get into the, you know, the minutiae of what did and did not happen on 9/11. But generally speaking, that Israel and her agents in the who had sort of burrowed their way into the U.S. government through entryism, you could say, had, you know, staged a false flag operation, pinned it instantly on Muslims. You know, a lot of these bin Laden videos, even like experts, academic experts on bin Laden in the, who are quite establishmentarian figures in the U.S. have said they're sort of bogus, faked videos. If you look at the different bin Laden videos, there's sort of a fat bin Laden and a thin bin Laden, and his nose looks different in each video. So they pinned it on bin Laden, who was on a dialysis machine and dying at the time in Pakistan. And that ignited this international war on international Islamic terrorism. It created a perception of a threat posed by terrorism, even though you're far more likely to die from smoking or in a car crash or from lightning, as I say, in the US, even after 9/11. And that managed to goad and lure the US into fighting wars for Israel. So it was a false flag operation, the same with 7/7. We just had this shooting in Ottawa, just as Canada's government was deciding to start lobbing bombs upon the people of Iraq. Of course, in 2003, Canada didn't go to war against the people of Iraq. And Canada's Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, who's more like Israel's viceroy to the colony of Canada currently, he said he was ashamed to be a Canadian when we didn't invade Iraq in 2003. Now Canada's, you know, this dubious shooting has sort of legitimated the idea of Canada bombing Iraq. So all these incidents, there is a huge constituency of, you know, well-credentialed people. Like, there's a group called Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and I've hung out with Richard Gage quite a bit. Professor Hall and I brought him into the University of Lethbridge to do a lecture. They have like like almost 3,000 like credentialed architects and engineers who have said this, the way that NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, explained the events of 9/11 is not compatible with laws of physics and laws of engineering. Like NIST has actually admitted that Building 7 fell at free fall speed. So for the, maybe not all your listeners know, but on 9/11 there was World Trade Center 1 and 2. Those two buildings were, at least we were told, sort of hit by flying objects, which we were told by planes. But then suddenly out of nowhere, this Building 7 just collapsed in 6.5 seconds, having been hit by no plane. And it only had sort of small office fires. And so for that to have fallen at free fall speed, then all like the resistant material would have had to have been removed at exactly the same time for that to have fallen in the way we observe it to have fallen, which is symmetrically and smoothly into its own footprint. And Larry Silverstein then went on TV on a PBS interview and said, oh, the flames were getting out of control, so we decided to pull it, and that we watched the building come down. And so a lot of people allege that Larry Silverstein sort of confessed to having been involved in a demolition. There's firefighters. There's a professor in the east of Canada called Professor Graham McQueen, who founded the Peace Studies Unit at McMaster University, and he decided that he was going to use his expertise to critically analyze the testimony of the firefighters. There was sort of like hundreds of written testimonies published from the firefighters on 9/11, and they testified that like they heard countdowns to a demolition and so on. And obviously, if you're going to like rig up the towers with the explosive materials which would be necessary to create the observed effects, for example, of Building 7 falling symmetrically into its footprint, that would take like months of preparation. It's not something that a ragtag group of Islamists hailing from a cave in Afghanistan could have done. And so there's this huge Israeli dimension to this. Obviously, I'm sure your listeners know of, you know, the USS Liberty incident, the fact that Israel did this false flag attack on the USS Liberty in June 1967. And recently, the Australian ex-Prime Minister Malcolm Fraser came on this radio show hosted by this rather nasty Zionist on Australia's public broadcaster, John Fain. And he said to this Zionist interviewer, he said, well, I know that Israel did that deliberately. My sources have told me for sure that Israel did that deliberately. And he was reflecting upon also recent remarks made by Australia's foreign minister, that the Gillard government, Julia Gillard was until recently the Prime Minister of Australia, the former Foreign Minister of Australia said that she, quote unquote, subcontracted Australia's foreign policy to Israel. So, you know, Israel has this long history of engaging in false flag terrorism, doing war by deception to pilfer the motto of the Israeli Mossad, to lure foreign powers into doing its bidding, into fighting its wars. This started in, I think it was 1956 with the Levant Affair, where Israel went into Egypt and started blowing up strategic buildings and so on, in order to encourage the British not to withdraw from the Suez Canal, and in order to turn the US against Arab nationalism, because the US was trying to sort of co-opt Arab nationalism at that time and prevent them from gravitating toward the orbit of the Soviet Union. There was the USS Liberty incident. You know, there's multiple examples of Israel engaging in false flag terrorism. And, you know, this whole war on terrorism, in many people's opinion, is based on a ruse that if they find sort of like fanatical, obscurantist Islamic zealots, that such people are treated as assets, not as threats, not as liabilities, but as assets. And there's always these drills, you know, on 7/7, it was announced that by this security company, oh, it just so happened we were running a drill. Envisaging exactly what happened, you know, like the exact stations would be subjected to a terrorist attack. And so, you know, the allegation would be perhaps Islamists are co-opted and told, okay, we're doing a drill and you're the actors, just carry this backpack. And then that backpack actually has explosives in, and suddenly they're pinned as the terrorists. You know, there's all kinds of ways you could posit this. But I mean, I think the thing with the 9/11 truth movement is there's just so many people with letters after their name, serious academics. I mean, in Canada, we have people like Professor John McMurtry. He's a member of the Royal Society of Canada, who's a 9/11 truther. Like, very prestigious academics have said, you know, this interpretation that we were given within hours of what happened on 9/11 is not credible. You know, there is a faction that say, oh, we're just going to focus on refuting the official story rather than speculating as to what did happen. But after a while, you know, people did say you can't just keep, you know, doing lectures on Building 7 for like the next three decades. Like at some point you have to come off the fence and say what you think did happen. But I think 9/11 was an Israeli false flag operation aimed at getting the US to fight wars in the Middle East, which only serve Israel, because they learned their lesson from, for example, George Bush Sr., that it wasn't going to be easy necessarily to get the US to go and topple Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein had fired Scud missiles at Israel in the 1990s, but he didn't pose a threat to the American people. And so Israel had this problem. And so through entryism, they got these neocons to burrow their way into the Republican Party and set up all the necessary context for this Israeli false flag to be covered up and to be used to justify Israeli wars.
Two follow-ups to that. One, how was the Liberty a false flag operation? Was it ever attributed to anybody but the Israelis?
Well, I gather that the planes had been decorated with the Egyptian insignia, I gather. But yes, I mean, there is a distinction to be made between the different, you know, one is just an attack, obviously. One, we say LIHOP, let it happen on purpose. That would be like Pearl Harbor, where, you know, it wasn't that the U.S. like dressed up their own planes in Japanese insignia and then bombed their own people. It was actually Japanese planes that bombed Pearl Harbor. I think that the Israelis did decorate their planes with Egyptian insignia. And so in that sense, it could have been the case that originally Israel was hoping that the U.S. would think that Egypt had attacked the USS Liberty, which would have justified the U.S. coming in to back up Israel as she was expanding in the so-called Six-Day War into the Sinai and into the Golan Heights and so on. But yes, that, you know, arguably that was more just an overt attack. If you overlook that aspect of things, the Pearl Harbor, the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor was what we called LIHOP, let it happen on purpose. And with 9/11, originally there was this whole crowd of LIHOP theorists who said, yeah, you know, so the US, they had friends in Afghanistan, but this was an external attack done by like 19 hijackers with box cutters. The US just allowed it to happen on purpose. But, you know, the scholars now have written many books just demonstrating that there's no evidence actually any hijackers boarded any planes on 9/11. In fact, even the BBC reported that some of the 9/11 hijackers turned up alive after the event. And so, you know, the whole of 9/11 was basically a farce. But yes, I mean, to answer your question, with regard to the USS Liberty now, it's more or less accepted that that was an attack. But I think there was an attempt to try and, on the Israeli behalf, to try and get fingers pointed at Egypt, its enemy.
And the other follow-up I wanted to ask is, I've always thought that discussions of controlled demolitions and things like that are somewhat overkill. If the purpose of 9/11 was to get the United States into a war with Israel's enemies in the Middle East, which certainly did happen, it seems like crashing a couple of airplanes into the Twin Towers would be a sufficient provocation for a war in and of itself, no matter what happened to the towers, and B, also sufficient to completely total them for insurance purposes. So it just strikes me as sort of an odd positing of overkill to say that the buildings were somehow demolished. What do you think to that, about that line of, I guess, objection?
Well, obviously, there's a question of what would you and I have done had we been neocons wanting to do a false flag on 9/11? And then there's the question of what have the experts told us? You know, there's an amazing video of this guy named Danny Juwenko, who was Holland's most prestigious controlled demolition expert and an engineering professor, where a 9/11 truther sat him down, showed him a video of Building 7 collapsing. He didn't know what it was. And he said, oh, it's a controlled demolition. It's a classic controlled demolition. You can see the crimp and all that. So, you know, there's kind of like the hypothetical scenario of what would Greg Johnson, the neocon, and Joshua Blakeney, the neocon, have done had they been wanting to foist a false flag on the American people, and then what the controlled demolition experts say actually happened on that day. Incidentally, Danny Juwenko drove into a tree recently and killed himself very suspiciously. Anyway, so there's that aspect of things. But yeah, I mean, you look at... I mean, this was a psychological operation, right? And the idea of having these sort of icons of American capitalism and American prosperity crumbling to the ground would have an optimum effect. Or it could be Larry Silverstein needing to cash in. I don't know what the incentive was. But, you know, this was an attempt to radically change the U.S.'s foreign policy and radically alter U.S. society. And so perhaps to have the desired effect, they thought it was necessary to destroy the buildings in their totality. But, no, I didn't plot 9/11. All I can say is this is what the controlled demolitions experts have said. And I think anyone who looks at World Trade Center Building 7 collapsing especially would have to admit that's a classic controlled demolition, just as Holland's controlled demolition expert said.
Well, it is odd that a third building falls down, even though only two of them were apparently hit by airplanes. So, yeah, let's go into another topic. You are now a correspondent with Press TV. Tell me about that, your interest in Iran, how that evolved. Have you met people like Ahmadinejad? Have you traveled to Iran? Just give us an overview of your involvement with Iran and how that came about.
Yeah. So I was demonized by the Zionist media, mainly by Jewish journalists in the Zionist media, for my stances I was taking vis-a-vis 9/11 in my academic work. And, you know, as I got into 9/11 studies, I was not only just studying 9/11, which they disliked. I began going on like internet radio shows and writing articles saying, I think Israel did this, which, you know, obviously would have made such Zionist journalists more displeased with me. And so when you get the Zionist press attacking you, you make a lot of friends. And Press TV, I don't know what year exactly it was founded but I think it was something like 2007. You know, Press TV is the sort of Iranian English language service. And they are obviously looking for people to contribute to their shows. And I began getting contacted by a lady named Sohilia, who was in the newsroom at Press TV. And she'd invite me on from time to time to comment on geopolitical matters, you know, what's happening in Palestine or whatever. You know, you can imagine it's quite a challenge for them. I mean, they want to do a news bulletin every 30 minutes. And you have to find people from all around the world who can comment on affairs and comment in a way that's actually not just going to be like parroting Zionist propaganda, but which is going to give a genuine critical analysis of what's going on. And, you know, Iran is so stigmatized and stereotyped in the West. A lot of people would be scared to talk to Iranians, I imagine. You know, a lot of professors, mainstream professors, would say, oh, it's bad for my career if I appear on Press TV and so on. So I started appearing on Press TV regularly, and, you know, they'd even get like studios here in Calgary, and I'd go and appear from like, it's kind of funny, I'd go to like the mainstream media studios, and I'd be having all these people from like the Zionist owned media holding the cameras and setting it up, and I'd be talking about Zionist ownership of the media with these people like setting up the operation for this live broadcast on Press TV. It's kind of funny. And anyway, so then we began the conversation of the idea of, you know, well, you have correspondents in Paris, in London, in Tokyo, but I noticed you don't have a correspondent in Canada. And, you know, I'm actually quite good at like video editing and not bad with a camera and all that. Like, I said, why don't I have a stab at it and try and become your Canadian correspondent? And so that obviously irked the Zionist media a lot more, and they began attacking me a lot and targeting me even more and calling me Iran's mouthpiece in Canada and all that. One National Post article, a journalist said that Press TV workers should be quote-unquote harried and hounded. I've even received a threat from an email address purporting to be that of the Jewish Defense League, saying, you know, that I might be targeted by the Jewish Defense League for being Press TV's Canadian correspondent. But yeah, so I you know, until then I had mainly focused on what the US was doing, what Israel was doing, and less so on Canada. But I decided to start doing reports from Canada, from Calgary, where I live, addressing, you know, the idea that Canada's government is engaging in gross hypocrisy. For example, in 2011, Canada's ruling neoconservatives seized a majority of seats in Canada's parliament in a fraudulent election. People who don't vote for that party received automated messages saying your polling booth has changed, the address of your polling booth has changed, so go here to vote, and people would turn up there and they weren't able to cast their ballot. So you have Canada lecturing Iran on democracy and on human rights when Canada's government is able to come to power in a fraudulent election, has been engaging in very sort of anti-democratic policies, I would say, on behalf of a kind of Zionist clique that has taken over this country. So it just so happens that, you know, I ended up being Press TV's Canadian correspondent just at a time when the Zionists were taking over this country. I mean, I don't think there's any country in the world that's more pro-Israel than Canada is right now. I think Canada is more pro-Israel than the United States is. We voted against Palestinian statehood at the United Nations. Canada's government is basically adopting Israeli foreign policy goals as a carbon copy. Canada's military is fighting wars for Israel right now. We sort of have Jewish corporations, Jewish-owned corporations, usurping Canada's resources. You know, Canada is a resource superpower. It has the third largest oil reserves in the world, the second largest diamond reserves in the world, the second largest gold reserves in the world. And you can imagine that the usual suspects would want to usurp that wealth. You know, I have a background in being cognizant of the plight of Native Americans, and so I have done some reports addressing that. You know, Human Rights Watch brought out a report recently saying Native Americans were being raped by police, or had accused the police of raping them. So Canada, yeah, when you have a government that's sort of in a very arrogant way lecturing another country on democracy and human rights, when its own government is committing violations of human rights and is basically turning this country into a sort of neo-feudal Jewish exceptionalist police state, I don't think that that should be allowed to happen without the necessary criticism. And so I was submitting reports, like packages to Press TV, you know, full reports with different people I was interviewing. But more recently, I just appear on Press TV from time to time because I have other projects I want to work on. And there's certain limitations, obviously, reporting from Calgary, because there's only a certain amount of intellectuals who I thought were sort of desirable to interview. So I'm doing less reports now and now just focusing on doing live interviews and also working on other little projects that I have in the works at the moment. So
have you traveled to Iran?
I've been invited to conferences. They have a couple of conferences every year, one on Hollywoodism, and then they most recently had this New Horizons conference, but that coincided with my visit to Japan that I recently did. So I mean, it will happen eventually. I'll probably will go on to one of their conferences, but you know, I have lots of projects I'm working on. But yeah, I do get invited to those conferences. And my professor, Professor Hall, my mentor, he went to the New Horizons conference recently. So I haven't been there yet, though. No.
So do you know people like Alain Soral or Dudonné, who are, I think, very interesting figures in France and seem to have a certain overlap and interest with you?
Yes. Well, I can't communicate with Soral and Dudonné just because I've lost so much of my French. As a child, I went to France like every summer, and I used to be quite conversant in French, but I've forgotten a lot of my French, so I can't really communicate with French intellectuals unless they speak English. But I am quite close with Gilad Atzmon, the Israeli-born saxophonist and philosopher. You know, he always tags me in his posts on Facebook, and I've interviewed him, and we communicate by email and have chats from time to time. So you know, I'm close with Gilad, and I must say I've been influenced heavily by Gilad Atzmon's work, and he's really sort of helped me to think through a lot of the shortcomings of the left. He's basically, his main focus is criticizing Jewish leftists, or criticizing the left in general, and so his critique of the left has really helped me think through my own philosophical outlook on life. And so I'm close with Gilad, who I know partly because of his musicianship is going to France quite frequently, and he is interacting with Dudonné and Soral. I think Gilad recently performed at Dudonné's theater in Paris. So through Gilad, I'm able to glean a certain understanding of what they're doing. And I can watch, you know, videos with them speaking and understand basically what they're saying. I interviewed Dr. Robert Faurisson recently. Interestingly, Dr. Faurisson was born in the small town in England that I went to school in, Shepperton, which is sort of in the suburbs of London. And I did interview Dr. Robert Faurisson recently. And so part of my intellectual evolution, of course, is coming to the realization that Marxism is sort of based on a gross exaggeration of, for example, the negative aspects of National Socialism in Germany, with a concurrent denial of all communist crimes. And so, you know, as I got into 9/11, obviously, there was all kinds of debates in the 9/11 truth movement. You know, should we expel so-called Holocaust deniers from our ranks? Should we expel so-called anti-Semites from our ranks? That was, you know, there was a big faction in the 9/11 truth movement who wanted to do that, who wanted to be politically correct, and had this idea that if we could just frame the 9/11 discussion in the correct way, we could persuade the Guardian to report on it, and we could persuade progressive MPs to raise it in Parliament.
Right.
You know, there was this, my professor compared it to the gay rights movement, that at first there were these gays who wanted to put on suits and be presentable, and then there were like the drag queens. And he and Professor Hall said that I was sort of in the drag queen camp of the truth movement, because I just wanted to you know, give the full truth and not be politically correct. So yeah, so obviously as I got involved in this idea of Israel attacking America and Jewish intellectuals propagating grotesque lies because they serve the interests of Israel or the organized Jewish community, one does end up saying, well, what else has, you know, been falsely represented to us? And so, yeah, I, you know, obviously I looked into the Holocaust stuff. And yeah, you realize basically on almost all these issues, we've been lied to. All the things that have been claimed about the enemies of the Zionists were not done by them, but were done by the Zionists in this case of sort of projection that we see time and time again. So, yeah, so you know, obviously it's just amazing, you know, that the left is predicated on a large fabric of lies, and one has to see through that. And when you see through that, being a leftist sort of becomes indefensible. That doesn't mean you have to say, you know, I don't support working class people having free healthcare and, you know, a social safety net. I don't say that, but, you know, there are obviously many components of leftist thought which are valid. I mean, I think this is a funny thing. I mean, I think the base superstructure dialectic that Karl Marx identified is basically correct, right? So the idea of the people who own all the capital define the superstructure, legality and culture and the arts and every sort of metaphysical aspect of society is defined, or to a large extent is influenced by those who own capital. I think that's correct. But if that's correct, then how do we explain the output, for example, of Hollywood? Or how do we explain the multiculturalist policies of our regime? Or how do we explain the radical promotion of homosexuality in our society? If our society is ruled, as the left presupposes, by like white racist men, why is it that white racist men, or men who promote, for example, Holocaust revisionism, are locked up? I mean, this is one of the things living in Canada. Canada's regime has a long history of throwing people in jail for questioning Jewish power and for abandoning Jewish exceptionalism. If Marxists are correct and those who own capital define the superstructure, why is that happening? Why did the Calgary police here just now on Gay Pride Day have the rainbow flag fluttering in front of their police station if the state is merely a product of those who own capital? When I was in Japan recently, they had a show on, and they went to Paris and showed the Eiffel Tower, and they went to different countries, London, and showed Buckingham Palace. And then they went to Canada and they showed two men kissing in Vancouver. That was the icon of Canada in the Japanese mind. How do we explain that if as the left claims, we're ruled by white, racist, heterosexual men? Why do we have this? Obviously, you have to then ask, you know, is the ownership of capital ethnicized in our society? And then you run into this problem on the left where they subscribe to this radical Jewish exceptionalism. They would never dream of demonizing someone for talking about Africana culture and the Calvinist religion and the chosenness of those who ruled South Africa under apartheid, or talking about Wagner and German culture vis-a-vis a certain regime in Germany, the post-1933 government of Germany. But when you talk about Jewishness and Jewish culture, and this is where Gilad runs into problems, you do get demonized and in some instances locked up. So why do we have laws that basically make it illegal to criticize Jews if the Marxian worldview of capital dictating legality is valid? That's what you have to ask yourself.
Right. Well, it, to me, what it basically says is that it's really not capital that rules. It's really not the base superstructure analysis that's ultimately determinative of historical trends. What's determinative of historical trends are idealistic or ideological currents. And one of the most fundamental ones is racial identity and racial idealism. I think that Jews rule because of racial identity and racial idealism and a long history of accommodating themselves and preparing themselves, if you will, to the pursuit of domination over other peoples. I just don't think Marxism really is true at all in that sense. I'm a historical idealist, I guess. I do think that obviously if you have money, you can get things done. But then the question is, why do Jews gravitate towards, say, monopolizing the media, right? Whereas other groups that are market dominant minorities, you know, the Patels, why do Gujaratis want to monopolize hotels and Jews want to monopolize banking and the media? Well, I think it's a difference in their sense of destiny as a people, their sense of identity as a people. Jews have been telling themselves for a very long time that their destiny is to rule over the other nations. And so because of that, they don't just seek money and accumulation of capital. They seek the accumulation of the levers of power through money in order to serve their identity, their sense of destiny. I'm more of an idealist, I guess, when it comes to the philosophy of history than a materialist in that sense.
Yeah, I mean, I think you need both components. You need a certain ideological predisposition which impels a group to want to seize power in that way. Because obviously, like, when Chinese people come to Canada, they don't just turn up here and, like, buy up all the media and try and co-opt all the politicians. So I think that you need to have a certain culture, but you also need to have the capital. I mean, if Jews had the same economic status as Native Americans, they wouldn't be able to be so powerful in the West, right? So I think you need both. You need the ideological sort of aggressiveness plus the means to foist that upon a nation, right? And so I think to some extent there is obviously some truth. The fact that Hollywood is owned by who it's owned by is obviously the reason that the American public have been able to have their minds controlled by Zionists, right? So I mean, there's a symbiotic relationship between capital ownership and a certain ideology that's necessary, right? And this is the thing when it comes to critiquing multiculturalism. I do think it's necessary to break down the attitudes and values of different ethnic groups. As I hinted, I'm sort of a Japanophile, and I think there's a lot of evidence that when Japanese turn up in a country, they just contribute positively to a nation, whereas other ethnic groups, as we've noted, don't. You know what, like, I know you're a proponent, for example, of ethnostates, and I think that that's an interesting idea, and it shouldn't just be negated completely, but I think there's like a softer way of preserving white interests and white identity. I mean, at university, I took a class on the history of immigration to North America, and it's the same as the US. Like, Canada just decided in the late 1960s to shift immigration policy from bringing in people from Ireland and Germany and France and England to bringing people in from all around the world. You know, that could just be reversed, right? I'm not necessarily on side with the idea of repatriation. I kind of like the idea of the West Coast, like Vancouver, being a sort of Chinese city or Chinese area, but I also see how white people need their areas where they have a certain amount of sovereignty. And then, of course, in Canada, you have the very interesting phenomenon of French Canada, of Quebec, right? And if we hadn't had mass third world immigration to Quebec, you'd basically have a relatively ethnically homogeneous polity existing within the framework of a bigger jurisdiction, Canada. And I kind of like that, too. I think the existence of Quebec in Canada is a very positive thing, although now you have people from all around the world living there from the former French colonies and so on. But, you know, I think that different ethnic groups can share sovereignty. And I think coming back to what my professor concluded in his research about the American Revolution, I think one reason he likes Canada is that it did sort of seem that the French Catholics, the white WASPs from Britain, and the Native Americans found a way of living symbiotically and cooperatively where each peoples had their sort of own areas and own territories, but it didn't necessarily have to be delineated in a stiff, rigid way through the erection of states, right, or sub-states within that country. So I'm very interested in the ideas that, that you and your colleagues proffer. And I, you know, I'm one of these people who's at this stage, I can't say I really have an ideology that can be pigeonholed. I'm just sort of shopping around and trying to be syncretic and synthetic and absorbing all the ideas which seem to make sense to me.
My mother's family are all Canadians. My mother is still a Canadian citizen.
Oh, yeah.
And I do remember the constant complaining about bilingualism amongst Anglo-Canadians. And I do remember that my mother basically had the view that if she had been allowed to vote on Quebec's independence, that she would have voted to get rid of them. So, yeah, within Canada, there is a certain tapestry, I suppose, a certain modus vivendi has been arrived at. But there is a great deal of tension, I think, between Anglo-Canadians and French-Canadians, which is one reason why there has been, you know, a drive for independence of Quebec. I wouldn't have any objection to there being a sovereign Quebec, a sovereign Francophone Quebec, and maybe that would calm down some of the tensions in Canada over things like bilingualism. Let me shift to another topic, namely your current project, Non-Aligned Media. I think you should try and plug that a bit. Tell us a bit how that came about and tell us what you envision it becoming.
Yep. So when I was somebody who presupposed the veracity of the official story of the Holocaust and embraced Marxian ideas, someone called Brandon Martinez, who's a journalist based here in Canada, actually wrote a critique of me. And so he started as a critic of mine, but now we're close friends. And he and I, Brandon Martinez and I, decided to found Non-Aligned Media. I like the Non-Aligned movement. Iran is currently the chair of the Non-Aligned movement. That was originally incepted at Bandung in 1955 by basically third world countries, but China was there and other countries were there who said, you know, we don't want to have to choose between this false dichotomy of US style capitalism and Soviet style communism. So I thought the Non-Aligned Media was sort of a good meme. I know you sort of have, you and I have discussed before the idea of self-determination and sovereignty for all peoples of the world. So I think that really is a good raison d'etre to adopt the idea of, you know, supporting the sovereignty of each nation and so on, and rejecting illegitimate global power structures, which try to homogenize different nations. So, you know, Non-Aligned Media, it's a catchy meme, right? So we use that that epithet for the title of our new site. And, you know, we're trying to take the approach of doing quality, not quantity. In a way, I often say to Brandon, you know, oh, we should do what Countercurrents does, you know, the very high quality output. So, yeah, so we just got that started recently. Brandon has recently put out a couple of books. One is an anthology of his writings. And another one is his work on the Zionist origins of the war on terror and Israeli involvement in 9/11. You know, if people want to read more about what did and did not happen on 9/11 and the sort of Jewish-Israeli angle of it, you know, they can read Brandon's work. But also Christopher Bolin is one of the top scholars of 9/11 and the Zionist aspect. And Kevin Barrett is another good scholar of that. I share a radio show, actually, with Professor James Fetzer. When I interviewed you recently, Greg, that was for The Real Deal. Professor Fetzer is one of the foremost scholars of the JFK assassination and of 9/11. But I sort of just post that on the Non-Aligned Media site. Now that has been incepted. So, it's nonalinedmedia.com. And, you know, we don't necessarily post every day. We try to put at least something up every week. When I do an interview on Press TV, it will get posted there. That's what we're doing. And we're trying to, if I go to the site right now, I can just read the, we enumerated a few points in the about section as to what we stand for. And we wrote, drawing inspiration from the Non-Aligned Movement, especially the organization's rejection of illegitimate global power structures, Non-Aligned Media exists to expose in particular the negative outgrowths of the global Zionist American empire. Founded by journalists Brandon Martinez and Joshua Blakeney, reoccurring themes of Non-Aligned Media include false flag terrorism, the Israel lobby, the mainstream media, Hollywood and Zionism, historical revisionism, supposed just wars historically and contemporarily, ethnic exceptionalism, who can be ethnocentric and who cannot, race and cultural relativism, the globalization of the Israel-Palestine conflict, thought crime legislation, and the state regulation of history, theology and supremacism, the geopolitical battles over the Middle East, nationalism versus internationalism. So that's really a précis of what we stand for.
Well, that's a very good précis, and it's a very good website. I'm always going there when something new pops up, and I recommend it to all of my listeners. So, Joshua, let's end on a sort of positive note. What is your picture of a better world? You said your worldview is evolving somewhat, but surely you have some picture of the way that you would like to see the world be, say, in the next 10, 15, or 20 years. So what's your picture of utopia, and what are some of the steps you'd like to see along the way to that?
So, you know, as I intimated, the non-aligned movement's presupposition that all states should have the right to self-determination and to equality in the world in that sense, you know, I support that, obviously. In terms of sort of social policies and the way a country ought to be structured, I mean, I think that a lot has to be said for context. You know, I think what might suit European peoples won't necessarily suit the Muslim world, for example. I mean, I think that there is a case for apples and oranges in one sort of analysis of how the world ought to be structured. So, you know, the thing with Marxism, this idea that I used to have of like the one communistic model will suit every people and every country on earth. I mean, obviously that's ridiculous. You know, I support, you know, people deciding their own fate in different contexts, which will probably result in certain egalitarian social systems and others being more inegalitarian. I mean, I must admit, I am interested in the idea of, you know, a benevolent elite, maybe an inegalitarian society that has an elite which actually cares about the well-being of the body politic. I agree with you that ethno-states and having kinship does seem to foster that sort of benevolence among the elite. I mean, I think one of the other things I am really interested in is the work of people like Philip Rushton and Kevin MacDonald and others who have drawn attention to the biological variants within the human family and the idea of the distribution of IQs among a people. I mean, there is a reality that much of the working class, even in white societies, likes beer and sports and is not particularly intelligent. I mean, the premise of Marxist approaches to the world is that the working class has the capacity to all be philosophers and all be, you know, involved in high culture and high philosophy. And so the idea is you rid yourself of this parasitic ruling class and the working class will be able to control the means of production and decide their own fate. Well, of course, there is always a segment of the working class which has a very high IQ and is economically poor for structural reasons, but there is also the truth that much of the working class is would be incompetent were it given power. And so there is a certain elitism which I find attractive, but it has to be the right kind of elitism, not the kind that we live in today. And obviously, we live in a very unique situation because of Jewish power in North America. And obviously, I don't support that. So I find it very interesting the way you have the normative values which you have espoused and the some of the prescriptions you have offered, the idea of an inegalitarian society. I think, yeah, you know, ethno-states have a lot going for them, as I suggested with Japan. You know, I look to Japan very favorably. I think that, as I said, women in Japan have a very stable identities. They don't have the kind of man-hatred which they've been inculcated with in our society. I think that the ethnocentrism, the ethno-homogeneity of Japan, it has certain downsides, but generally is a positive thing. I think, you know, I look to Japan and say, you know, maybe if England hadn't had this sort of neo-Marxist Frankfurt School ideology foisted upon it, that England would have ended up looking that way instead of having, you know, the radical feminism and the multiculturalism and so on. So I try to look at different countries. I've traveled to more than 20 countries now in my life and seen different societies. And so I'm also interested in sort of neo-pagan ideas and bringing back that which was eliminated unjustifiably. In other words, looking back to tradition and trying to revive those traditions which would actually improve things. Because, I mean, I think that the left has changed society under the guise of progress, but they've actually obviously regressed society a great deal. And so the idea of returning to the Enlightenment ideal of progress, but actually reaching into our past to revive things like the patriarchal family, which might actually make society more stable, which existed in the past, but which has been done away with for ideological reasons and thus made us worse. I mean, the left, that, you know, then as you've said, the left is sort of this Jewish ethnic phenomenon. We've had our society destabilized, but under the banner of progress. So we've regressed under the banner of progress. And so it seems that we do have to have a kind of return to the past whilst also trying to be contemporary at the same time. So there's a balance to be struck, I suppose.
Well, Joshua, that's very, very eloquent, and I think that's a really nice way of wrapping up this conversation. I feel like I've gotten to know you a lot better, and I hope that's true of our listeners as well. So until next time, thank you for being on Countercurrents Radio.
It's a great privilege, Greg. Thanks for inviting me.
Countercurrents Radio is the voice of Countercurrents Publishing and the North American New Right. Visit us at www.countercurrents.com. That's counter-currents.com.